Last night somebody asked a question about attachments, so today I will give a talk about attachments and detachments and non-attachments. Because sometimes when it gets to the end of the day, sometimes I'm tired and other people are tired. So it's a good question, but I never gave it much respect, as it were, because I was trying to just pass through it very quickly. So today, whoever asked that question, I'm going to get a whole talk today on attachments and detachments and all these other attachments. But first of all, I did mention last night that the word attachment, it comes from a Pali word called upadana, which has another meaning, which is like a fuel. And that gives a deeper meaning of what this really word attachment truly is. Because the attachments which are really the problem for us are those which fuel further suffering, which make the fire of worry and fear and craving and suffering burn stronger and stronger. In other words, they keep samsara, this round of rebirth, rolling ever faster. And that's what we mean by the fuel, the source of the problems of life. When you get an idea, it's also a fuel. It makes it much more interesting to see how it works. And also, it's interesting to see how attachments work, because you can already notice that the way we've been meditating here for the last many days, it's all about going in the opposite direction to attachment. See how much you can let go, how much you can abandon, how much you can free of yourself, to hold nothing at all. And so you can see that what we've been practicing during the last few days, you know, is in the opposite direction of attachments, trying to let go of more things rather than carry on holding on to things. But of course, the first problem with attachments is that people who come into Buddhism, first of all, and they have an idea that Buddhists shouldn't be attached, and they're not quite sure what you shouldn't be attached to and what you should be attached to. And they think you should let go of so much and everything, but you shouldn't be attached to your precepts, you shouldn't be attached to going to the temple, you shouldn't be attached to calling yourself a Buddhist, you shouldn't be attached to anything except your money. Because it's so hard to get a donation out of these people. But they're not attached to everything except their wallet. But we have to, when you actually go, so see what the Buddha actually said, and you understand this from your practice, there are some things which are really worth attaching to for the time being. And there are other things which are worth letting go of. And like your precepts is one of the things which is worth attaching to. The Buddha gave the simile of a raft to go from one side of a body of water to the other, from a place of danger and suffering to a place of peace and happiness. So, you know, you have to attach to that raft if you're going to go across. If you, when you're crossing that river on the raft, if you read a book, oh, I shouldn't be attached to anything, and jump off the raft, you'll get eaten by the sharks and drown if you don't get gobbled up by the sharks. In other words, you will die. You've got to attach to the raft until it takes you across. So we attach to our precepts until it gives us the freedom from the problems which the precepts were there to protect you from in the first place. So we attach to some things first of all. Years ago I gave the simile of a ladder. If you're going to climb up onto the roof, then what you do in climbing up a ladder, you attach to the rung on top of you, ahead of you, above you. You grasp onto that as tightly as you possibly can, and you let go of the rungs underneath you, and that way you can pull yourself further up the ladder. There comes a time later on, sure, that the rung of the ladder which you grasped onto very tightly a few minutes ago, you are now standing on, and now it's the time to let go and to move higher, you know, from that rung. And so much of the experiential practice of our path, we attach to things for the time being to take us further across. It's not just one raft which we use, but many, many rafts which we use to get across. In other words, to get across from suffering, to find some peace, happiness, and meaning in our life. So it is true, it should attach to some of the precepts, understanding their purpose, what they're there for. But even those precepts, when we understand what they're there for, we understand actually how far we should use them and when we should loosen off. Which is why many years ago I did give the simile of the traffic lights. And the simile of the traffic lights is when you come to a red traffic light, you're supposed to stop. In fact, if you go through, there may be a police camera, you'll get fined and lose points because of you go across the red traffic light. But must you always stop at the red traffic light? What happens if Ajahn Brahm has a heart attack? When you put me in your car, if you stop at the red traffic lights, it's bad karma. If I don't. You've got to get to the hospital as fast as possible. So what do you do when you get to, if I had a heart attack and you're rushing me to hospital, what would you do? You get to the red traffic light and you pause. You look around and make sure it was safe. You wouldn't just go through and kill me with a car crash before I get treated in the hospital. So you stop. Have a look around, and if you think in this particular situation it's very, very serious, you think it's safe, you go through. And that's obviously no one, not even the police, would ever sort of criticize you for that or fine you, because it's an emergency. And that's understood. But sometimes the red traffic lights can be crossed in emergencies. But you've got to be very, very wise to be able to do that. Because if you just cross just because you're late for work, then you're going to get in big trouble. And it's the same way that your precepts there. When you understand what they're really there for, and you can understand what they're used for, then you can understand how much you can bend, how much you can't bend. And usually you don't bend very much, because once you understand these precepts, you understand they are like a safety harness. They keep you from injuring yourself. And it's better, as they say on the aircraft, to keep yourself buckled in with your seatbelt on rather than not, because you never know what's going to happen next. It's like a safety procedure to keep those precepts. And then you understand what you're doing, and it's not really an attachment anymore, it's a wise understanding. You're holding on to that rung to stop you falling off the ladder so eventually it can pull you higher up. But as you get higher up, sometimes people say, oh, when you get really enlightened, you can let go of all your precepts, you can do whatever you want. Now, once you're enlightened, you can have sex, you can go to the pub, you can watch movies, you can actually do whatever you want, smoke dope, because you're enlightened now, you've got no attachments, who cares? Again, that doesn't understand the whole process of enlightenment, because it's not just letting go of, it's not letting go of precepts so much, it's letting go of the underlying things which those precepts are there to overcome, which is why the Buddha actually said that the main attachments, the ones you should really look out for, the ones which create rebirth and suffering, he said, they used to say sometimes three, sometimes four, but the third and fourth one are basically the same. It's the attachments or the upadana to the five sense world. They call that karma upadana. And the upadana or the attachment or the fuel of views or basically wrong views, silly views, stuck views. And sometimes they have another one, especially the view of the self. In the other words, the attachment misunderstanding of the meaning of these rules and rituals and rites and everything else. And when people attach to those sorts of things in the wrong way, they get into big amounts of trouble. Like I was saying last night about the superstitions which people have. And that is basically the attachment to these rites and rituals, to the way things are done. For example, I don't know, it is the tradition, and many of you Buddhists know, that when you put a Buddha statue up, it should be facing which direction? East. It's supposed to be facing east. If it doesn't face east, what will happen? What direction is that one facing? We got into trouble once because in our monastery in Serpentine, we had this lovely Buddha statue all the way from Thailand. And we put it up in the hall and it was facing west. And people criticized us and they say, something bad is going to happen to your monastery. Because the Buddha statue is facing in the wrong direction. Now, fortunately, we had a senior monk come, one of Ajahn Chah's great monks. I said, what are you guys talking about? Look, if the Buddha wanted to face east, he'd turn around himself. And that was the end of the problem. Great monks are like that, because they somehow they say something and straight away the problem disappears. And so that Buddha statue has been facing west for the last 25 years and nothing's happened to our monastery. We've been perfectly okay. So it doesn't really matter, but sometimes people do get attached to those types of superstitions. If it's a Buddha statue, it doesn't really matter so much. It's only a small thing. But there's other superstitions which people get attached to which are really dangerous. And I don't think I told this in Singapore a couple of weeks ago. But this is a custom, especially in Thailand. That is a couple of customs. Well, the first one is, you're not supposed, if you're a monk, you're not supposed to sit next to a girl. On the aircraft or on the bus. And I've been keeping that very strictly for many years. And I was sending a Thai monk who was visiting Australia. And so he came to Perth first of all. And then I escorted him to the domestic terminal in Perth Airport. He was going to take a flight to Melbourne to see the monasteries over there. So as I helped him check in at the counter in Qantas, there was an Australian lady at the counter, and I said, excuse me, would you mind give him a seat not next to a woman? I got the wrong person behind the counter. Because she said, what's wrong with women? There's nothing wrong with women. Are we diseased or something? Oh, she really let me out of there. Okay, anywhere, please. Just put it somewhere on the plane. Anywhere will do. And so that was the last time I asked for special seats. So that's how I've been too scared. So it is a senior monk. If it's like a young monk who's just an ordained, you know, when he's young monk, he's having a monastery, then sure enough I'd be a bit more careful. They're old monks, Jim, and they're all big enough to look after themselves by this time. So that sometimes you try it, you know, if it's all possible, but you don't make a big deal of it. You don't think it's something evil or you can get infected or something. But sometimes you've got no choice about the matter. And it's the same as some of these other things. I already mentioned about women aren't supposed to touch you, especially those big buffalo nurses who stab you with antibiotics. But I mean, one of those customs, which in Thailand was really ridiculous and actually dangerous, was the custom. Fortunately, I don't think they do this in Sri Lanka, is actually to put the monk at the front of the bus. They always put the monk in the front seat of these buses in Thailand. And I remember it etched into my mind because I was traumatized for a couple of hours when this bus driver, he picked me up in Chonburi and it was taking me into Bangkok, which is maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. It's a big highway, so they really rush really fast down this highway. And those of you who've seen Thai drivers, even the best of the time, they don't really sort of take much care. The death toll is huge in Thailand. And so they put the monks in the front of the bus because the monks have the good karma to protect all the people behind them. So if you've got a monk in the front of the bus, no fear of a front-end collision. So there you were. As soon as I got on the bus, actually the bus driver was smiling more than usual. Now, Thais usually smile, they respect monks, but he was smiling more than usual. I wonder what he was up to. I soon found out after 1 or 2 minutes, because as he was driving the bus, there was a movie on the bus, on the sort of TV screen. And it's a really good movie, because he loved it, because he was watching the movie. Oh, while he was supposed to be driving the bus. And there was I sitting in the front, and all these cars and trucks were coming, so he was weaving over the lanes. He wasn't paying any attention at all. It was my job to stop the collision, so he could watch. Well, that was a very dangerous and very frightening journey. So what do you do things like that for? You know, kidding your monks. But once I tried that once, and that superstition, because I thought that all Thais would do that. So one day when I was flying on Thai Airways, economy class, I said, well, why don't you put me up the front like they do with the buses so I can stop and eat? Because you all know what the front is. That's first class. So I'd have taken that. But of course they wouldn't accept that at all. So I had to sit in economy class again. But you see, those superstitions, those are sort of attachments which we should really sort of challenge. Now, all this of the attachments to, sometimes people in Singapore were asking me, is it okay to read, say, the sutras on the toilet? And I said, I'm glad you're reading them somewhere. It's better not to read them at all. So it really depends on why you're doing it, what you're doing. So there's none of these hard and fast rules. Because when we understand the purpose of these things, then we understand what these attachments are. Sometimes because you were told by one monk, you know, which you really respect, and you say, it's wrong to read the Buddha's teachings on the toilet. And they say, sadhu, sadhu, no, that was a great monk, it must be right. It's not, just a monk gives you some advice, but you don't follow it 100%. You know, you're not a sheep, you know, you're a human being. So you think about it, and you contemplate it, it's advice, it's not a command. So you shouldn't do everything which I tell you, alright? Yeah. And you're doing everything. So you know, the idea of Buddhism is to contemplate, to investigate. So we're not really, we take these things as advice, all the teachings of the Buddha are advice, and we don't make a big thing of it. What I said the other day about that very embarrassing statement by the Buddha, if you were a Dane bhikkhuni, then this asana would only last 500 years. But was that, just because it's said by the Buddha, does that mean that it's 100% certain? We actually don't know if it really was said by the Buddha or not. It may have been misinterpreted because we've seen some of the teachings actually change. So why not make a big thing of it? Well, I don't agree with that, so I don't have to follow it. Can you do that? Remember, the truth is in the heart, not in the books. If you keep following the books and just read them and follow them without contemplating them, you're not really understanding what Buddhism is. So you don't have to make big deals out of these things. So in other words, that's the sort of attachments which we have. We call that, I'll say these three attachments, that's the attachments of views. And those are the hardest ones, one of the hardest ones for people to break through of. Now the views which we have, sometimes we find it very, very hard to let go. The Buddha actually had a sense of humour, because he told some wonderful stories, and if you actually read them in the original Pali, you end up laughing your head off because they're just human stupidity. One of the stories which he told was of these two men who decided to go and seek their fortune, and so they went off to a place and they found an abandoned village. Now for some reason or another, the town or the village had fled, probably because of some invasion by some foreign army or something, and they left everything. And so when they went in there, they found some hemp. And it was quite a lot of hemp, so it would be quite valuable. So they said, oh wow, this is really good, we can take this home and sell it and make a lot of money. So they both made a big bundle of hemp and they put it on their heads and started walking home. But as they were walking home, one of them, actually they both, they saw some hempen cloth, which they've already, you know, like a sort of stuff which you use for jeans, what's that called, not canvas, whatever, canvas will do. A very rough cloth. And they said, well, that's actually what you use hemp for, to make the cloth. So one of them sort of threw away his bundle of hemp and took up a big bundle of cloth. And the other guy said, I've already sort of, you know, packed this up, it's already so nice, so I'm going to leave it as it is. And so they walked on, one with the bundle of hemp on his head, the other one with the hemp cloth. And as they came further, they found some linen cloth. And then they found some cotton cloth. And then they found some silver. And then they found some gold. And each stage, one of these guys said, I've been carrying this long enough, it's all right for me. While the other one was willing to change every time he saw something more valuable, he'd throw away something less valuable. And so when they got home, one of these guys had a big pile of gold on his head, and the other one had a big pile of hemp on his head. And in understated humour, the Buddha said, the fellow who brought back the hemp did not bring any pleasure to his family and friends. Because he was stupid. If you find something more valuable, throw away the old stuff and take the new stuff. I can see why people's views are like that. But sometimes when we have a particular way of seeing things or doing things, it's our view. I'm a Theravada Buddhist, I'm a Thai Buddhist, I'm a Burmese Buddhist, I'm a Sri Lankan, I'm a Singaporean. And sometimes we attach to those views so hard, we are unwilling to give it up when we see something better. It's called dogmatism. And one of the other pieces of graffiti I remember from my time at Cambridge was this was scrawled on the walls of the Cavendish Laboratory, you know, the physics laboratory in Cambridge. In those days, graffiti was interesting because it actually meant something and it was usually very witty. I remember one of the graffiti was exams, killed by degrees, which I thought was very, very good. But this particular graffiti was on the outside of the physics department, was the eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time he or she obstructs progress in their field. And I thought it was a wonderful saying. The eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time they obstruct progress in their field. Which is why even scientists get really dogmatic. And even Buddhists get dogmatic. It's an attachment to views. And the Buddha was actually telling you again and again, if you have any view whatsoever, any idea of the meaning of life, the way things work, who you are, and how things work, if you find a better view, then you should jettison the old view as soon as possible and carry the new view. So you don't get attached to these old views, because old views actually prevent you from actually seeing the way things truly are. And as you see, in this path of meditation, some of you have to jettison old views. Some of you may have come from the Vipassana tradition or from other traditions. You say, what's Ajahn Brahm talking about? So you don't jettison it straight away just because I say it. You investigate, have a look, see if it works. And then, if it does work, jettison the old one. Just because it comes from a particular monk, well, Ajahn Brahm, you find something better than what I say. Please jettison what I say and get the better view. Because that's the Buddhism. That is actually not being so attached to these views. These views are those rafts, and you use them to grow across. And there is such a thing as a right view, but that right view is very, very simple. No view of emptiness, of non-self, and nothing being here. And you can see how this works, because as you are meditating, there's more and more times you come across these attachments, which stop you getting deeper. And I also mentioned at the beginning, one of those biggest attachments, not the views or the rites and rituals, is the attachment to this sensory world. And it's amazing that, you know, here you're well fed, you know, you've got a nice room, it may not be the best, but how often can't we stop and just leave the sensory world behind and just sit and let go of the body and food? You're going to get fed later on, why think about it now? But a lot of times we're so attached to things like food, to things like physical comfort. There's a classic Buddhist story. I know it was actually in Joseph Goldstein's book, but I heard it many, many times before, because it went around the whole of Thailand. It was a story of how people catch monkeys. I think it's actually from the Buddhist scriptures, one of the commentaries somewhere, that how people in India used to catch monkeys. It was very simple to catch a monkey. All you needed to do was get a coconut and a piece of strong rope. And, you know, you'd get the coconut and you'd, you know, drink it and the milk and eat the flesh. And you'd hollow it out. But you'd just leave a little hole in the top. Just big enough for a monkey to put his paw into the coconut. And then you'd tie that coconut with the string to a tree. And you'd put a banana in the coconut. Inside. And monkeys like bananas. So all you need to do is to tie that coconut to a tree and you can go home and have a nice rest. Sure enough, later on, a monkey will find that coconut with a nice juicy banana. But remember, the hole is just big enough for the monkey to put its paw in. But not big enough to take its paw out with a banana inside. And so the monkey has to try and figure out how to get the banana out and his hand out at the same time. It can't do two at the same time because the hole's not big enough. Because as soon as you grasp something, your hand gets bigger. So, later on, the man, the hunter, comes along and he ambles close to where the coconut is and a monkey sees him coming. And what does a monkey do? Does a monkey let go of the banana and run away? Even though there's many other bananas in the forest, the monkey can't let that banana go. You know why? Because it's my banana, he's a monkey. I found it and it's mine. And the monkey struggles even harder to try and get his paw out with the banana. And of course he just will not let the banana go and escape with his life. And that's how the hunter catches the monkey. You can understand how that works. But sometimes there are some things we're so attached to. If there was a fire in this retreat center now, and the alarm bells would go, and would you go into your room to create your belongings first of all? That's called attachment. You ask any sort of fire officer, that kills people. When they run back in the house to get their wallet, to get their purse, to get whatever else they think is really valuable for them. That's called attachment. And sometimes people lose their life because of attachments. And people have told me who work in the air industry, if there is a crash, when you leave the aircraft, you're supposed to leave all your belongings inside. Very few people do. Some people even run back into the aircraft to get their last piece of belongings and kill themselves. It's amazing just how attachments can sometimes kill us. So, those are the attachments which we're supposed to let go of. And these are the attachments to things of the sensory world. So, you know, what do you own anyway? You know, it's all going to leave you in the end. You don't own your wife or your husband. Or you're probably playing around somewhere with somebody else while you're on retreat. They're all, who knows? Are you sure? Are you worried? Don't say, I know my husband. No, you don't know my wife. People surprise you sometimes. But anyway, who cares anyway, sort of, you know, that let them go. What are you actually attached to? That's actually the exercise there. But why do we allow these things to burden us? You know, that I often tell people I've got monasteries, which I'm supposed to look after. When I come on a retreat, you forget about the monasteries. When you go overseas, I forget about the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. I never carry the Buddhist Society of Western Australia on the aircraft with me. It's, you know, too much excess baggage. I don't mean over the limit on the weighing machine. I mean, it's just too much baggage from my head. So you learn how to let go of this physical world and all these things which you're supposed to own, belong to you, which are supposed to be yours. Because it's amazing just how many times we are actually attached to these physical things. It's amazing what I found is, like, very elderly people, when they get very old, they can actually let go of many, many things. And even when they get a bit of dementia, Alzheimer's disease, very often they actually forget about, you know, where they left their dress or, you know, where sort of even they live sometimes. But, you know, I've had experience that the one thing which elderly people, they never forget when they've got Alzheimer's disease, is their bank balance. It's true. Sometimes they know exactly how much money they've got and how much money is missing or whatever. Which actually shows you just what their attachments truly are. It's funny, I'm not quite sure if you've had that experience, but I remember sort of some woman, she was forgetful about everything. But when I asked her about this was that lady who had offered the $50,000, I don't know if I told you this, $50,000 for a chaitya, for a stupa in Bunyana Monastery. But because of our rules, any money which is offered, we have to keep it for that purpose. We can't use it for anything else. So we decided we didn't want to build that stupa, so we went to see her to tell her, do you want the money back, because we don't want to use it for this monument. And if we don't want to build it, we have to give the money back. But she actually said, I'll use it for whatever you want. But at that particular time, she had dementia. And I was really quite concerned whether she'd remember it, but she remembered everything. That was actually one example amongst many. Because what we're attached to, that's what we really remember. Now, when you start to let go in meditation, what thoughts come into your mind? And why do they come into your mind? And that's actually showing you what your attachments truly are. If you're thinking about your husband, your wife, your kids, that's what you're attached to. Because why do you have to think about it? This is retreat time. It's nothing to do with you on retreat. You know, you've sort of left the world for 9 days. So whatever comes into your mind, you can actually know that, yeah, that's one of our attachments. So don't delude yourself. That's the stuff which stops you being free. You're grabbing onto that banana and you won't let it go. even though if you let it go, you'll be free, peaceful, and get into deep meditation. So when the thoughts, distracting thoughts, do come up, please understand that's a lesson in attachment. You attach that. Why can't I let it go? Your business, your money, your family, whatever. You know, your travel plans, because tomorrow the retreat finishes. And we have all these plans about what we'll do next. But who knows? What time you're going to the airport? If you're flying Qantas, Qantas is very often delayed, even cancelled. So sometimes, I've done that many times, had the flights cancelled or delayed. I remember one time I went to Thailand. I've been there for many, many years, and people received me with such a lot of friendliness, and even the people gave me a big party, just, you know, as far as a monk can have a party, you know, extra bit of coffee, just before I left, and they waved me off and say, oh, please come back again soon. And 2 hours later, I was back again, because I missed the plane. It's very embarrassing when people give you a going away party, and then you come back again. But you don't know, the future's uncertain, so don't be attached to the things of the future. Who knows what's going to happen next? So, it's those thoughts and plans and worries. You know, the other thing which we're really attached to, again, is our past. Why, even though we should not think of the past, do we keep on allowing it to come up inside of us? Especially, as I was mentioning in one of the interviews, why are we attached to the pain of the past? If anything you should let go of, it's the pain of the past. But, fascinating, human beings, we attach to the pain. You know why? Because that defines us. When we talk about attachments being fuel, a fuel for what? It is actually the fuel for our sense of self. Everything we attach to, that is what we're built up of. That's our ego, our self, our identity. We are the product of our attachments. That's why it's called a fuel. The flame is the product of the wick, the wax, and the heat. That's what it's made up of. That's what you're made up of. Everything you attach to, everything you think you own, everything which belongs to you, that's who you are. When you look at it that way, you understand why sometimes people are attached to the pain of the past. They've actually built an identity out of that. That's who they are. One of the first times I really saw this very clearly was when I went to give a speech at a conference on death and dying, on grief, at the Scarborough Beach Hotel, Observation City it was called, a few years ago. And there were some very, very famous grief people, the parents of Kiera Glennon, for those of you who know that she was one of the victims of the Claremont serial killer. And there was other, I forget who they were now, but that's the couple I remember. And there was other people who were made famous by their grief. And I mentioned that very carefully, made famous for their grief. And when I went on there and said about letting go of your grief and not needing to carry it, and you can just let the past be and drop the shit of the past, a couple of people were very upset at me, and they sort of buttonholed me afterwards and said, you shouldn't say that. And I was just so surprised that all I was trying to suggest was ways to be free of the grief and move on in life and have more happiness. But that offended them so deeply that I really reflected on that afterwards. What have I said which was wrong? All I'd really said which was wrong, I reflected afterwards. I was destroying their personality. That's who they were. That gave them meaning in life. Their grief. That's what gave them an identity in the world which made them stand out. And I was telling them to disappear. That's what they're offended with. And I see that many times it's our past, you know, being the victim, you know, being the person who's been abused, being the person who's been hurt. Sometimes that is an attachment to the past, which is even worse than the monkey and the banana. You just will not let go of that and be free, even though it hurts us, and we have to remember that past with pain again and again and again. Now those are the attachments which as Buddhists we really should be looking at, investigating and letting go of. Because otherwise, you know, what's the point of meditating? We'll never get peaceful, you know, so far. We'll never get to the point of meditation, I meant to say. We get a little bit peaceful and the pain of the past will come up, we'll either remember it or we'll think we don't deserve to be happy again. So we'll never get to the deep states of meditation. When I, this is one example amongst many of how sort of the attachments which we have actually make ourselves, make our identity. I realized as a monk for a long time I was trying to let go of my attachments, many of them in my past, worries about the future, now my desires and cravings. But it was such a difficult thing to do for me to let go of attachments. I noticed, for example, when I became a monk, I let go of sex. But then I was actually attaching to food. Now, every time you got a nice meal, you really got sort of huge amounts of pleasure on it. It was like a rush of pleasure, and I was very attached to food as a young monk. And then I tried to get rid of that, and then I got attached to tea. And then you try and get rid of that. You know, I did actually give up tea for 1 year. I remember when I made that announcement to my friends over at Bodhinyana Monastery, Ajahn Yanadhamma was there. And he came to my hut afterwards, after I said I'm giving up tea for the range retreat, maybe a bit longer. And he came up and begged me not to do it. I said, what do you mean begging me not to give up tea? He said, look, I was with another monk, Kemananda, and he'd gave up tea for 3 months, and he was impossible to live with. Please don't give up tea. Well, I thought that was more of a challenge. I didn't know how to confirm that story. That was okay in the end. But you know, you give up these things just to see if you can. But it was so difficult. You know, you take up one thing and you sort of give it up. And it was just, you know, it's like, I get the simile of like having a hand. Whenever you have a hand, you keep picking up things. You say, stop it, put it down. So you put it down, and a few minutes later you pick up something and come on, stop it, stop it. It's not something else. Now that's what attachment is like. You'll find that as soon as you give up one attachment in life, you pick up another one. So I don't know what you like. You like movies. You say, nah, I've had it with movies. I'm going to give up movies. And then you sort of take up like sport, going to watch the cricket. No, it's stupid. Look how stupid sport is. Now it really is. Now look, you know, if you say follow, cricket is of all the sports is one of the best sports to follow. The reason is there's only a few teams, so your chance of winning is increased. If it's something like soccer, when every nation has a soccer team, your chances of winning are just diminished by the number of people who participate in that sport. So I've often noticed that they have, I think, the World Cup soccer every 4 years. And I remember this because, you know, that was the national game in England. I remember that one time, I was a school teacher at the time, still a Buddhist at that time, a school teacher. And that evening, England was playing Poland. It was a World Cup qualifier. And all England needed to do was, the home match was to draw, and they'd go through to the finals. And it was a close match. And just in the last few minutes, it was nil all. They were going to go through, and then Poland scored! And it was disaster! The commentator would say, this is unfair, it's against the run, and actually there's still 10 minutes left. And they hit the post, and they hit the crossbar, goals disallowed. And the final whistle went. They'd lost. Ah! The next day when I went to school, you know, sometimes, you know, kids in the school, you know, full of life, they're naughty. Not naughty at all. No one was speaking to me. Even the teachers were depressed. It's one of the easiest days for keeping discipline. That's absolutely crazy. The whole country was depressed because of a stupid soccer match. What do you do that for? And I've seen that even since. Every 4 years you get this madness. People stay up late at night watching, and we were robbed. It was Australia the last time. They got very close. And was it a penalty at the last moment? And it wasn't a fair penalty. Oh, it wasn't fair, was it? No. And what happens afterwards? Everybody's depressed and suffering. Out of 64 teams, only one team goes home happy. And how long for? Day, 2 days, everyone forgets about it. So much suffering and so little happiness. It's a complete waste of time. Why do people do that? So they give up. They give up sort of stuff. And they go and take up something else. I remember this Thai lady, you know, this Thai lady book. She told me her mother, the Chinese Thai, she would really be attached to Chinese movies. And once a week, you know, she'd go to the movies. And when she'd come home again afterwards, her eyes were red. And you know, this young girl booked. And what, you know, what's been doing? So, oh, so sad. It's all so sad, the Chinese movies. Because apparently in the Chinese movies in those days, it's always boy meets girl, or girl meets boy, one of the two. And that's only two plot lines they have. And what happens afterwards, that something gets in the way after they get married, either the family or the imperial army or some natural disasters, and one of them gets killed or they get separated, they can't stay with each other, one becomes a monk or whatever. And it never ends happily. And so every week she cries, so sad, such a lovely couple and the imperial army got in the way. And she asked the monk, what are you doing that for? Every week you're suffering. I said, oh, it's so nice to cry. What do people do that for? Are you going to these horror movies and just scare yourself witless? What do you do that for? Why do you like suffering? People who watch cricket, that's what they like. They like suffering. How much happiness do they give you and how much suffering? Measure it. And you'll see it's much more suffering than happiness. You lose many more times than you win. So after a while you think, what are we doing that for? It's because we have a hand we have to attach to things. That's what a hand does. So when I saw that many years ago, I realized the hand, you know what the hand means? It's your sense of self. As long as you have a sense of self, you'll always start picking things up. You'll always start attaching. In the same way, when you have a hand, you'll always pick things up. So the only way to stop attachment, real attachment, is to see the non-self. The only way to stop picking things up with your hand, cut your hand off. That is the only way. You know, I remember getting that insight, meditating. This was over in Thailand many years ago, thinking, wow, what a wonderful insight that was. The inside of the hand which picks up. Because many of the similes, you know, they're written in Ajahn Brahms, I don't get them from anywhere else. But you know that particular insight, the simile of the hand? Some years later I was reading through the Sangyutta Nikaya and I saw the Buddha give the simile of the hand. Exactly the same. And that sent shivers down my spine as it does even now. I'd seen exactly the same simile which the Buddha used. Wow, that was spooky. Probably got it from a past life, it wasn't really mine anyway, but it really made a lot of sense that that was a simile I found myself, which was a Buddha simile. As long as you've got a hand, you'll pick things up. Attachment really comes from the sense of self. And as long as you've got a self in there, an ego, you think you exist, you'll always be attaching to something or other. Which is why that we have to see that non-self first of all, before we can really let go of the attachment. So letting go before seeing non-self is temporary at best. We let go just for the sense of peace and pleasure of meditation. But we only let go because we know that after we leave here we can eat whatever we want, we can watch the Chinese movies, we can check the cricket scores, and we can check our bank balance, and also what our partner's been doing while we've been away. We're not asking you to let go of everything straight away because you won't be able to do that. What we do have to say is to let go of some things temporarily. Just for the time being to see what it's like. Because when those attachments are let go for a short time, it's only then when you can see just the truth of these things, especially of non-self. There was always the core realization of Buddhism to see there's no one in here. Only then can you get to the root cause of attachment. When there's you, you have to be something, do something, own something. As the Buddha once said, when there's a self, there'll be things belonging to a self. So sometimes you want to find out who you are. It's nice to say, what do you own? What do you own? What are your possessions? That defines yourself. Which is why the big egos have to have big mansions. Flashy cars, even yachts, and many properties, because it shows they have a big ego. When you are someone, you have to own things. That's why, as Buddhist monks and nuns, we're supposed to own very few things. Not just
for the sake of simplicity or harshness, but as expression of letting go of ourselves. The fewer things you have, the less you exist. Even not having a bank balance, not having a credit card, makes it great fun being a monk. Whenever I go to Social Security, because I have a health care cut, you have to prove you exist. And they ask for all these documents. Your marriage license, certificate. I haven't got a marriage certificate. Your mortgage. Your ownership of your home. Your bank balance. Your sort of letter from the bank. Your tax file number. I don't work, so I haven't got a tax file number. As far as the government is concerned, I'm off the records. I don't exist. Because all the things which you're measured by in our world, by things like, you know, Social Security, by government agencies, is all things you own. That's how you're measured. When you own very little or nothing at all, basically you disappear. So it's great fun being off the record. And sometimes it causes a lot of difficulty for people. We can't prove you exist. Here I am. But it's not just the physical possessions which define you, it's also your mental possessions. Ah, you a good meditator. Now if you think you're a good meditator because the last retreat you had a good meditation, that's called an attachment. You're defining and making yourself, and that's a problem which stops you getting another deep meditation. You made yourself, and that gets in the way of letting go. Are you smart, wise, and clever? All three. Now that's why when we say something stupid and make a mistake, that's why we're so embarrassed we won't let anybody know what we did. That's why that we own so much of our mental stuff. When you don't own any of your mental stuff at all, when you can let go of that, then again, who are you? So you ask yourself, what do I own? What do I possess? And that is actually what we mean by yourself. And seeing all these things disappear, seeing all your possessions, physical and mental, disappear, that is the teaching which shows you, bright and clear, the fact there is no self. If you're built of what you own, or what you possess, what you can do, and all that disappears, then who are you anyway? When you see all of that and you disappear, only then is it possible to unravel the attachments of the past. That's why only a stream winner can really let go properly. Only then can you truly start the path of abandoning your attachments. Only then are you the learner, you start practicing. Only when you see the shore can you start swimming towards it. So this is actually why we start really letting go of the attachments. Before then, we're always attached to many, many things. And it's like a little trick to seduce you into letting go of enough attachments for the time being to see non-self so you can really let go of them totally, completely, once and for all. And as you let go of the attachments once and for all, only then does the attachments to what other people think of you or say about you, your ill will, or your attachments to having things always work out the way you want them to, your attachments to the future and your plans. Only then can you really let go of your past, you know, who did what to you and why, and what did you do yourself. As long as there's a self in there, you want to own the past, at least some of it. Once there's a self there, you will not be able to overcome or let go completely of your past. There's always some of that you think is you, who you are. I went to Cambridge, so I'm the Cambridge graduate. That's stupid. You know, as soon as I was a monk, the first time I went to visit my mother, I got out all the certificates, all the degrees, and I tore them up and put them in the dustbin. Because I'm a monk. I don't need all that stuff. That's the past. I'm not sort of a physicist anymore. And about an hour later, I saw my mother in the kitchen with all the certificates on the table and tasting them because I felt so terrible because I thought they were my certificates and I had the right to put them in the dustbin. But I realised my mother was proud of that and I felt so terrible. I was selfish. I was just thinking about myself and not thinking they didn't really belong to me, they belonged to my mother. So she kept them.
even though they were taught and taped carefully together. But when you can let go of things, who are you? And you can disappear, and only then can you have sort of the lack of attachment. And you know you've let go of things when you're willing to let these things go. When you're about to die, and you can say, bye-bye body, nice knowing you, all the best, I'm going somewhere else. When you can let go of your mind, when you're going crazy and the mind is just all over the place, you say, bye-bye mind, no, here's $20, pack your bag, see you later. When you don't own anything, you can let go. And that's called non-attachment. So when we say attachment, it's attachment to the sensory things like the body and the five senses. Why can't we just let the body disappear when we're meditating? It's a pain, we're ache here, an itch there. I'm going to sit down, shut up body, bye-bye, I'm just going off into jhana. Why can't you do that? The only reason is you can't let go of the body is because you're attached to it. That's why I noticed that sometimes when I was meditating years ago, you'd be sitting and getting quite peaceful and then you have an ache in the knee. And first of all I thought, oh, the knee's aching. But then I knew that if I was at a party or watching a movie as a young man, you never feel the ache. And I realised what I was doing. I was getting peaceful, but I was getting bored. And so I went out looking for anything to disturb myself. Anything going on down their knee? Oh yeah, there's an ache. Thank you very much. It's distractions. Just like people, as I say, when they're at home and they're bored, they go look in the fridge. Nothing to eat. Full of stuff. They go look, on the TV. 36 channels. There's nothing on the TV. They go look for a book in the library. Nothing to read. A whole library full of books. It's amazing people just, in this world they can get bored. In our modern world, you just go on the internet and go anywhere and see anything. So this is just seeking for a distraction. That's what I was doing, just seeking for something to disturb myself because I did not want to disappear. Now you can see those attachments coming up. Just one little piece of advice, which I wanted to give, not just like a talk on attachments and just make it all theory. A piece of advice, if you have an attachment like that, especially in your meditation, how do you overcome it? Temporarily, this is. And this is where I gave this first limit to a person during the interviews, but I wanted to share this with everybody because this is a powerful method of overcoming the blockages of your meditation, especially the attachments, and going deeper. You will find that there's one attachment which is your biggest blockage. Whether it's attachment to the past, some pain in the past, whether it's like the fear of actually losing your body, when you get to a certain stage of meditation, just can't let this body go and go into nimitta. It can be, you know, attachments to your family, always thinking about your son somewhere. Whatever that attachment is, remember what I call the simile of the snake. And this simile was from the time when I was with Ajahn Chah in Thailand. Poor monasteries in the jungles. The jungles had huge amounts of animals and creepy crawlies. Not only the ants would really hurt, so were the centipedes. The scorpions, actually, they didn't hurt that much. Centipedes were worse. And, of course, the snakes. And in that forest monastery, very often, we didn't have any sandals. We just didn't have them. When they broke, we tried to fix them. And if you couldn't fix them anymore, you had to go barefoot. Barefoot in the jungle, where there's all these snakes and animals around. And at night time, most of the time you had a flashlight, but sometimes the batteries would run out. And even though you tried, you know, with hardly any light at all, eventually even that light disappeared. I remember several times going to Ajahn Chah and said, look, my flashlight has run out of batteries, have you got any more batteries? And he would actually look quite sad, so we haven't got any. We just don't have any, you just have to do without. Because sometimes you'd run out of simple things. It was a very poor monastery. And so, very often, I would have to walk back from the hall after the evening meeting, chanting or talk, walk back maybe 500 meters to where my hut was, just barefoot through the jungle along the paths. Of course, I knew it was dangerous. There were snakes around. You see them very often. But because I knew there were snakes around, I was very alert. My mindfulness was very strong when you were afraid. And so I'm mindful as I was looking, as I was walking back under the starlight or the moonlight, there's always a tiny bit of light most of the time. If there wasn't, you have to use a candle.
And sometimes, you know, that was difficult because the candle would sometimes blow out, you have to light it again. So when you're walking there, whenever you saw what looked like it could be a snake along the path, a shadow of a tree, or it could have been a stick falling across the path, it didn't matter. You couldn't see it clearly, but if you thought it might be, you took a different path or you jumped over it, you were certainly very aware and careful until you got back to your hut. If I hadn't been aware that the snakes were there and taken precautions, I would have got bitten for sure. The symbol of the snake means this. In your meditation, it's like you're going from the hall into the deep meditations along a path which is not all that clearly lit, and there's snakes waiting for you on the path. Your biggest attachments, the stuff which has caught you so many times before and stopped you getting into deep meditation. Your big obstacle, whether again thinking about your family, fear, expectation, all these problems to meditation, these attachments which have stopped you letting go and going deep into meditation. When you know your particular big snake which has caught you many, many times, beginning of the meditation, you just psych yourself up. Like I psyched myself up when I left the hall, I said, there are snakes around, be careful of these. Stop thinking about all sorts of meaning of life stuff and just be aware of where you're walking, the snakes around. Because I was aware, I psyched myself up, I cautioned myself, I was always alert for the sign of a snake. If you do this in your meditation, say it's fear, you'll always be alert for the sign of fear coming up in your mind. And just like those snakes, I saw them before I was even close to them, before they could strike me. If you psych yourself up that way before you meditate, you'll see, say, fear or expectation before it's strong enough to get hold of you and stop you progressing. You can take another route, jump over it, but you can certainly transcend it easily. So if it's expectation is your problem in meditation, it's always stopped you sort of going deeper. You say to yourself, that is my snake, expectation. I'm going to be really alert to this and really aware of it, so I see it way before it grabs me. And that's what happens. You're going in your meditation and you start to see the first sign of expectation. When it's the first sign, you don't need to follow it at all. You can take another path. You know it's danger. That's actually the symbol of the snake. That really helped me many, many times in meditation. It's helped many other people. You identify your big problem, whether it's fear or just wandering thoughts. Wandering thoughts has caught me so many times. So that's my snake. I've been attached to that, and I'm going to break the habit, because much attachment is just bad habits. Automatic conditioning, which we're trying to change. And that's how you change it. So there are many attachments in life. They all come from the sense of self. And this is the place where one undoes those attachments. First of all, temporarily, in this meditation, by getting so still and so peaceful and so free, one is not holding on to anything. And then one is free, one sees the truth of non-self. And afterwards, it becomes so much easier to let go of things, knowing you don't own anything anyway. It's not your husband, it's not your wife, it's not your son. They don't belong to you. Especially your children, they come into your life, who knows from where. When they get married, they go somewhere else. Bye bye. They're not yours. It's not your body. You rent it out for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years, and then you have to give it back to the earth. It's not your body. It's not your intelligence. Intelligence comes, intelligence goes. If you live long enough, you'll all be demented. So it's not your intelligence. So it's not your health. In fact, you own very little. And the less you own, the more you realize that, the easier it is to let go, and the easier it is to disappear. And letting go of the final attachment is when you disappear completely. When you own nothing, when you give up everything, when there's nothing left, you disappear too. You'll find the owner is the owned. You are your possessions. When you let go of your possessions, you are no longer there. Phew, at last.
does it talk about attachments? Are there any questions or comments or complaints about today's talk on attachments? Thank you so much. I'm so happy that you recognize the brilliance of this. They won't last. Tomorrow's talk will be a stupid one. Yeah. Too late, once the snake has got you, stupid again. So you come back again, it doesn't really kill you, it just gives you a lot of pain. Say, okay, next time, I won't be so stupid. But that's how, because sometimes we forget to be on the lookout. So that's why it's a wonderful simile. Once it's got you many times, you know what keeps stopping you getting into deep meditation, or at least getting deeper in meditation. The same old problem occurs again and again and again, probably for the last 8 days. The main thing was stopped you getting deeper every time, or at least many days. You just say, that's what it is. When I can tell myself to be aware of that, be careful of that, avoid it. And yet you do see it before it gets you. And that's usually the trick, to see it before you actually start picking it up. Once you've picked it up, it's in your hand. It's very hard to let it go. But when you haven't picked it up yet, come on, stop it. Don't pick it up. No, no, no. No. You don't pick it up. Okay, so that's the ball game for this morning. There are now interviews for those people who put your name up. Maybe another 5 minutes you can put your name on there, but please don't put it at the very end. Please don't space them out, because that means I have to wait for you. And that's bad karma. So just put it under the person's on the top there. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4. Then I can do some meditation as well. Have a nice time. So that's some interviews if you really need it. So have a nice meditation. Remember, now is the time your energies, all the causes and conditions have been building up over the last days. It's like the volcano has been building up pressure. Like the tsunami of insight is about to burst forth. Like the flower in bud, it's been bulging and bulging. It's about to blossom into wonderful wisdom. Like the juicy mango on the tree, it's just so fragrant and so delicious. It's about to fall. But if you go and sort of have a cup of tea or just go and have a rest, miss it again. So remember, you've got to be under the mango tree to catch it when it falls. So please don't waste too much time, you know, especially the last days. This is the time to, you know, your job is to put your bum on the cushion or the seat as much as you possibly can. If you prefer walking meditation, to get out and then walk as much as you can. What you actually do when you actually get on the cushion, when you start walking, that's when you begin to do the letting go. So, but put the energy just to get in there. Sit under the mango tree. And if you sit under there long enough, sure enough, the mango will fall. So now is the time for putting your bum on the seat, for putting your feet on the walking path, and spending hour after hour and see what happens. Okay, very good. So, happy meditation.
Looking to the future, this kind of expectation of what, you know, what's ahead of where you're at. And when we start doing that, you know, that's when we lose our mindfulness in the present moment. So everything in terms of the stages is all encompassed in the present moment. All we have to do is to be here. And then if the mind becomes more peaceful, things will start to happen by themselves. We don't need to kind of worry whether we're going fast enough. We don't need to worry, what should I do next? As a matter of fact, what should I do next? It's a terrible question. Because one, it takes you somewhere else. The present moment, like I said last night, is the beginning of the path, the middle, and the end. You don't get enlightened in the future sometime. That's not going to happen. Happiness, the bliss that I've been talked about, is not something that happens in the future as well. It happens all in the present moment. right here, right now. Okay? So that's why, you know, when I do teach meditation, I'm always trying to, you know, emphasize, yes, these are stages, but sometimes, you know, looking to the end too quickly, it in itself is an obstacle. All we need to do is just be happy and be in the present moment and know that all the happiness that we ever want, all the wisdom that we ever want is right inside of us right now. All we have to do is be patient and have the courage and the faith in the Buddhist teaching and just sit right here and wait for things to happen. Okay? Let's see, I forgot anything else. A story about my first meditation. I can still remember now. It was in the south of Thailand, and I didn't know anything about meditation. So I went on it because I wanted to be. I spent a year in Wapananachat, which is a Thai monastery. And they said that you can't stay long-term unless you knew some meditation. So I went to down south, Son Mok, at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery. I think he passed away, but it's a 9-day retreat. And the thing that struck me was that was true, because I didn't know, have any expectation. I didn't do too much reading beforehand either what meditation is. I was told to focus on the breathing, the breath, and I did that. And as anything, it's like, you know, and the thing is a good kind of thing to share is that because of no expectation, and it must be some past karma, the meditation went very quickly, not very quickly, but it was very enjoyable, and you know, became very peaceful very quickly, because I didn't know what to expect. I was just, you know, very interested in the breath, and just watch it in the present moment. And the clarity, I remember, the clarity that came up during the first few days was quite surprising. Because, you know, as a lay person, a very busy person, working in the finance industry, you know, trying to run around all day long, and didn't have that much mindfulness. But obviously, with anybody with low mindfulness, you're not aware that you're not aware. So you're like, yeah, I'm fine. I know what's happening. I'm, you know, whatever, running around. So it's only through the, you know, after the first few days of meditation that I realized that, you know, a lot of times, we may be physically somewhere, but we're, you know, literally off somewhere. It's like, you know, our present moment awareness is really smudged with lots and lots of the past, what happened a few hours ago, a few minutes ago, who you met on the way. And then it's also smeared with the future expectations. You know, one good example is like, you know, restaurants in Bangkok. Obviously, working the finance, you know, you get to wine and dine your clients. So I went to a very nice restaurant, but never taste the food. Usually in a restaurant, you don't sit quietly and eat. You're constantly babbling to your clients or your friends. Oh, yeah, nice decor, or you're drinking or something. So mindfulness is all lost. And the thing that struck me was that during that retreat, the food was very simple. But yet, I remember tasting really, really nice. I was, you know, was a bit surprised that this kind of simple rice porridge or something that they serve in the meditation tasted much better than all the nice restaurants I've gone to, and I couldn't understand why. So when he came here and Ajahn explained his same, you know, experience when he went to his first retreat, how better the food tasted when his meditation began to pick up. And it's when you see it's true that, you know, life for most of us, it's just so kind of traveling in a car with very, very dirty windows. It's just kind of glimpses here and there, and very, just a world of shadows, really. And we don't have mindfulness. And then it's only through brightening up our mindfulness, through meditation, that you can really experience what life is about. Yeah. And also, with the clarity, obviously, you know, simple things, you know, worldly things, like food tastes better, you can enjoy your sensual experience more. Like, you know, the colors, the flowers look better, and you can hear the sound more. But that's kind of, you know, the baby stuff, elementary stuff. When you look closely, with more clarity, also comes happiness. deep peace and contentment that comes from within. There's something that says inside of yourself that, you know, happiness is right here, right inside this body and mind of mine. All I need to do is to kind of tap it. I don't need a new car to make me happy. I don't need a new husband or a new wife to make me happy. I don't need a new career. Just everything is inside me, right here. And that's what gave me a lot of faith in the Buddhist teaching. That's what gave me faith, you know, to kind of go and join the monastery. Because all the happiness and all the clarity we ever want is right here. Okay? And that's the talk for this morning. Any questions and answer? Questions or comments? No. Excuse me? That's what I thought when I first joined. You know, I get my enlightenment out of the way first and go back and clean up in New York, but it doesn't quite work that way. But also because, you know, when, like I said, I did develop a kind of, when the first monk I met, and that's how he got me to start meditating. He says, you know, once you start to meditate, obviously, you know, things become more clear, and you, if you're kind of lucky or good at it, you can have some psychic powers, like, you know, seeing the future. And I was in finance, I'm like, I think I like this. But just, I thought, okay, I'll take a year off. I can give it a year and practice, see if I can, you know, see the future within a year. But I think that's kind of, maybe he knew ahead of time, but maybe he didn't. But when you become more peaceful, right, learn how to meditate, you live in the monastery, you live a very harmless, pure, beautiful lifestyle. Right? I'm not saying that just become a monk. I mean, anybody can become a monk or a nun. So. But it's harmless, it's peaceful, and you learn how to meditate. Why, and obviously happy and content doing it, why would you want to, you know, kind of trade that in and go back to a busy place, a busy job in Bangkok or in New York, you know, for whatever the rewards are, right? But yeah, initially that's why I thought, you know, get enlightened first, write a book, maybe a few movies. But it takes, unfortunately for myself anyway, it's taking longer than 5 years I anticipated. Maybe it takes about 5 lifetimes. But it doesn't matter, because I'm quite happy and quite content for the time and to pursue the path. So like Ajahn Brahm said, you know, it really doesn't matter. If you're happy and content, 1 lifetime, 100 lifetimes, what does it matter? In a samsara, you know, you've been here a few billion times already. So, you know, things are happy, you know, and just keep at it. And not worry about, you know, where you are, because there's a lot of conceit and kind of sense of self around it. Whether you have the perfection, the spiritual qualities that kind of finish off the work, or whether, you know, it will take you another 100 lifetimes. Basically, you just want to kind of compare with your fellow monks, and that's, you know, really not, neither here or there. Just as long as you stay with the peace and the contentment, then the Dhamma will develop on its own accord. You know, this, you know, our spiritual practice is like, you know, growing a tree. We just water it and we keep the bugs away. But whether the tree grows quickly or not, you know, something we have no control over. Just kind of keep constantly water it and allow the tree to grow at its own pace. Like I can say, most of us kind of have the faith in the Buddhist teaching of rebirth. You know, you've been here a few, you know, million times or billion times. So a lot of the causes, a lot of your spiritual qualities already been developed over many lifetimes. So in this lifetime, you can continue and kind of nudge you a little bit forward, but really, not a whole lot. Right? So just allow, you know, like I said, the main thing is just allow things to kind of unfold.